Our second lesson today begins with Matthew 12, verses 38 through 41. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you." But he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so for 3 days and three nights the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth. The people of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the proclamation of Jonah. And see, something greater than Jonah is here." We will also read 1 Peter 3, 18 through 20. "For Christ also suffered for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order to bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in former times did not obey, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah, during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. This is the word of the Lord." Christmas is coming, and people are out and about, going around visiting relatives. And in our first reading today, we find that Mary is going somewhere too. She is leaving her home and going to visit her relative, Elizabeth. But why is Mary going to see Elizabeth? It isn't really very good news that she is pregnant without being married, isn't it? Mary is leaving her town, perhaps with a little bit of fear, going alone into hiding away at a relative's house in another town, perhaps, as her belly starts to swell and her marriage is not yet consummated. There must have been some sort of trepidation on her part, since stoning was the usual price to be paid when a Jewish girl would get the marriage first and then motherhood order backwards. But Mary was taking a risk to follow the instructions of the Most High God. In her humanness, there must have been some strategic adjustment of her clothing and probably no little anxiety in front of her neighbors. But yet, there is amazement too. And even now, the supernatural implications come busting into her daily life. When Mary entered the house of her relatives, the Holy Spirit filled Elizabeth, and instantly there was recognition. The divine presence in Mary's womb was felt. It had an immediate impact on Elizabeth and her unborn son. That moment, the presence of the divine worked a change in that spiritual orientation, no matter what they were thinking about before. Like a compass needle swinging to their north, their human spirits were pulled toward this Holy One of Israel who had come to them where they were. Now, Jesus, our God, who we celebrate his coming to earth, was going somewhere too. This journey, which would ultimately lead him through the entire cast of human experiences of birth, life and death, would even lead Jesus to hell and back. In our ongoing series on the Apostles' Creed, today we come to a particular phrase concerning Jesus. He descended into hell. Now, there are many churches that completely leave that phrase out when they're reciting the creed. And this is not without some very good reasons. The first thing that we must know about this phrase is that it was late to come into acceptance in the Apostles' Creed. Rufinus, a theologian who lived about 400 AD, explicitly states that the phrase, "he descended into hell," was not in the Roman Creed in 200 AD, but instead it came from the bishop in the very independently minded see of Aquila, which is the area near Venice. Now, John Calvin agreed with this view of the creation of the creed, and he stated that this phrase was inserted after a time, but did not become customary in the churches at once, but only gradually. The Catholic Church teaches that this phrase was not even officially accepted as the teaching of the councils until 1215 AD. So it is good for us to know that this most controversial phrase in the creed was not completely agreed on in the past. And we should not be surprised that it is not universally agreed upon in the present. The second thing to know about this phrase, that in its earliest Greek form in the Apostles' Creed, it is katalathonia eista tau katata, which means, it's a mouthful, but it means he descended to the lowest place or to the underworld. Thus, a better translation of the phrase, "he descended into hell," would be that Jesus descended to the dead. Therefore, we shouldn't be surprised that many churches who choose to use the ecumenical version of the Apostles' Creed say in unison, "he descended to the dead." Now, the Reformed family of churches very rarely talk about hell. We are not people who typically try to scare anyone into our pews or try to motivate each other into correct behavior by threatening punishment from God. We are more likely to speak of the joys of heaven than the existence of hell. And because we don't talk about it, we as Reformed people do not really have a consensus about what hell is. Also, by not talking about hell, it has been appropriated by the secular world. When you think about it, what the hell, or what the hell is a very deep theological question, and not a swear word. What exactly is hell anyway? And if you accept this late adopted phrase into the Apostles' Creed and believe that Jesus descended into hell or descended to the dead, we should have some notion of what we mean by that. But let's begin with, what is hell? When the word hell is used, many of the mental pictures from Dante's Inferno, from the Divine Comedy, immediately come to our mind. In that vision of hell, there are nine layers, each one more terrible than the next. Dante describes people being whipped by demons or immersed in a lake of burning pitch. Each person in this place is described as suffering under unusual and very cruel punishments, each one suitable to their crime. But Dante's Inferno was written in the early 1300s, not very long after the phrase, "he descended into hell," was officially accepted into the creed. To project these Dantean visions of the hell of the New Testament is very anachronistic. These are the visions of hell that came into being much later than the vision of hell that Christ preached to among the people of the first century. So how was their worldview of hell shaped in the first century? First, we have to go back to even an older view of hell. And we find the ancient Jewish view was of the underworld, which was called Sheol. And it was a place where all the dead go to be judged. The Jews also had the concept of Gehenna, which is that fiery pit stuff that we were talking about. It was also a word which the Hebrews used to describe the garbage dump, where garbage was burned up. Now, in the Jewish view, Gehenna was only a temporary place, a place of purification. In it, sinners would be purified by fire for maybe up to a year, but only some very terrible people would be there for eternity. So we have that Jewish view of hell, which Christ would have been preaching to, But also the view of hell that would also have been popular would have been that always evolving idea of the Greek underworld. The Greek view of the underworld had the pit of Tartarus, the river Styx, the ferryman Charon, and the land of the dead ruled by the god Hades. In the first century, everyone had a three-layered view of the physical world, with heaven above and earth in the middle, and hell deep underneath the earth. Thus, we shouldn't be surprised when Jesus speaks of descending to the depths of the earth in Matthew 12. It was an accurate depiction of what the first century people believed the cosmos to be shaped as. But with all of that being said about what they believed in the past, what do we believe that hell is now in the 21st century? The Barna Group has done some research on that. Of those who believe in hell, 32% of Christians believe that hell is a physical place where God punishes sinners for eternity, something which reminds me very much of the Dante or the Greek underworld views of hell. But also, other people, 39%, believe that hell is a state of eternal separation from God's presence. Eternal separation. A state of being. How could hell be a state of being? Both the Roman Catholic Church and the Handbook of Christian Apologetics from InterVarsity Press, two very different organizations, describe hell as a state of being, not as a physical place. Just as darkness is defined as the absence of light, so hell is defined as the absence of God. Hell is described as a place that is self-chosen, with a lost soul being characterized as someone who has rejected everything that is not simply themselves. People who believe that hell is a state of being remind us that any soul that refuses the one source of life and joy will find only death and misery. C.S. Lewis, the great theologian, in his seventh book of the Chronicles of Narnia series, The Last Battle, describes what happens when the dwarves, who are only for the dwarves, find themselves beyond the stable doors and into the afterworld in the land of Aslan, the lion, who is the god metaphor in C.S. Lewis' books. The section goes like this. Aslan raised his head and shook his mane. Instantly, a glorious feast appeared on the dwarves' knees. Pies and tongues and pigeons and trifles and ices. And each dwarf had a goblet of good wine in his right hand. But it wasn't much use. They couldn't taste it properly. They thought they were eating and drinking only the sort of things you might find in a stable. One said he was trying to eat a bit of hay, and another said that he had got a piece of old turnip, and a third said he'd found a raw cabbage leaf. And they raised their golden goblets of rich red wine to their lips, and they said, "Ugh, fancy drinking dirty water out of a trough that a donkey's been at. Never thought we'd come to this." Aslan explained what was happening to Lucy. "You see," said Aslan, "they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own minds, yet they are in that prison and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out." With all of these differing views of hell that people have, it is not surprising with what follows from that there are many different interpretations of that phrase that we're talking about today, "He descended into hell." The first interpretation is the simplest. Jesus had to go to the place of the dead because he actually died and was dead between Friday and Sunday, and was not just dead for a brief 30-second heart-stopping out-of-body experience. Thus, some people believe the phrase "he descended into hell" merely means that Jesus was actually, completely, totally dead. The second interpretation of this phrase is from the Heidelberg Catechism. In this interpretation, Jesus' descent into hell was only a metaphorical description of the agony that he suffered on the cross. This suffering by Jesus saved us from the anguish and torments of hell. Now, this is similar, but not identical, to John Calvin's interpretation of Christ's descent into hell. According to Calvin, an actual descent by Christ into an actual hell was necessary for all Christians' atonement, because Christ did, in fact, need to endure the penalty of that torment for the sins of the redeemed. And if that were not enough to have three views of hell, there is indeed a fourth. This last view of Christ's descent into hell is a theological premise known as the harrowing of hell. It is most strongly based on that tricky reference to 1 Peter 3 that we read earlier, that reference where Christ preached to those who were in prison after his death. This harrowing of hell argument describes all the prisoners of hell as like those who in the days of Noah turned their backs to God. And with this belief, there is a rich tradition that has grown up around it. There are artistic depictions of Christ breaking down hell's gates, or Christ leading a procession of saints beginning with Adam and Eve up out of a fiery pit. Now, with this version of the descent into hell, we have to ask the question, why would it be important for Jesus to bring the light of his love to hell? Even if you believe that hell is a state of being absent from God and not a physical place, there is still a great comfort in believing that there is no place in the universe that the sacrificial love of Jesus did not touch. Even John Calvin understands the importance of such a theological position. He stated of the descent into hell, "I readily admit that Christ shone upon them with the power of his Spirit, enabling them to realize that the grace which they had only tasted in hope was then manifested to the world." I don't know about you, but there is something very reassuring in knowing that when you die, there you will see the face of Jesus asking you to love, begging you to set aside the lie that your life is more important than the life of others. The face of Christ asking you to open yourself to the power of self-sacrificial love of God. Just as when Mary entered into the house of Elizabeth and Elizabeth's spirit swung like a compass to worship and praise that amazing presence of Christ, so I too believe that the presence of Christ exists in the realm of the dead, calling whomsoever will into a relationship. It is only those who refuse that invitation, those who choose to live for themselves, who will cut themselves off from God. It is by their own choice that they reject the source of love and purpose and live in a hell of spiritual misery, the kind of death that is separation from the Most High God. So this Advent season, where are you going? Are you like Mary, afraid perhaps of what others may think, but still going forward and following the call of Christ? Have you been in the presence of the Most High God and felt your soul swing like a compass needle toward the embodiment of eternal love on earth? This Advent, are you giving up your own comforts and your own status to bring a greater light to the world? Or are you so worried about not being taken in that you cannot take that step and believe that the God of the universe loves you? Do you choose your selfish life this Christmas? Or are you using this season of giving to self-sacrificially give to others? Ultimately, when it comes to the end of your life, do you know where you're going? I pray that you do. Amen.